Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Throughout much of history, there's been a great tension between those who claim the existence of God and those who don't. But there's a much greater issue at hand than just, you believe this, I believe that. Those who claim no higher power in the universe often attack the way in which believers, well, believe. They chalk it up to wish fulfillment, acculturation, mental illness or anomalies, and just plain superstition. And I will agree that all of these issues and more can play a part in how we view or experience the transcendent. But that doesn't mean that we cannot come to a mature, logical, philosophically, and psychologically appropriate understanding of divinity. Recently, my colleague at the Kauffman Interfaith Institute, Kelly Clark, authored a book entitled God in the Brain, The Rationality of Belief. Actually, he was in the studio with us just a few months ago to discuss a book to which he contributed on interfaith relations entitled Strangers, Neighbors, Friends. Our rule of thumb here at Common Threads is not to repeat a guest any more than once a year. But I thought that this was such a compelling topic that we needed to bring Dr. Clark in a bit sooner. A little bit about Kelly James Clark. As I mentioned, he is a colleague at Kauffman Interfaith Institute here at Grand Valley State University, where he serves as Senior Research Fellow. And his many books, other than the one that I just mentioned, include Written to be Heard with Paul Borgman, Return to Reason, and When Faith is Not Enough. So we welcome to Common Threads Kelly Clark. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Fred. Thanks for having me back. It's always a delight.
Certainly, it really is. We always get in good conversations here. So you've written several books on the philosophy of religion. What inspired this one, and do you think you've covered new ground here that you haven't before?
Yeah, this is a completely new topic for me, completely new in terms of a book. I've been writing articles on it for almost a decade. And, I'll be honest, this is what brought me into it. My former student, Justin Barrett, is a psychologist, and he's one of the leading psychologists in the world in the new field of cognitive science of religion. And he's a pioneer in that field, and he was he directed an institute at Oxford that looked into the cognitive science of religion. Cognitive science of religion is it's a set of sciences. Involves psychology, which Justin is, but it also can involve sociologists, anthropologists, philosophers, computer scientists. There are all sorts of fields that look at how our minds actually work. As philosophers, we always look at how we think a properly functioning mind should work, and cognitive science looks at how, in fact, it does work, how we take experiential inputs and then output beliefs and practices. How that happens? How does it really work that we see something and then we have visual beliefs, or we see something and we move out of the way, or we hear something and are frightened? What goes on in our brains when that happens? Justin had taken my class in philosophy of religion, and he thought the view that I defended in philosophy of religion was really close to what people were discovering in cognitive science of religion. So he invited me to Oxford to give a talk on cognitive science of religion and my views on the rationality of religious belief. At the time, I knew nothing about cognitive science of religion, like literally nothing, but I had the offer of a free trip to Oxford, and I just couldn't resist. So,
well, yeah.
Yeah. So I agreed to do it, and I spent the next probably 10 or 12 months boning up on cognitive science of religion. And I gave the talk, and I asked Justin if he would co-write with me a paper, because he's really good on cognitive science of religion. I'm on better in philosophy. So that was my first foray into it, giving this talk and then writing a paper with Justin.
And he wrote the foreword to your book.
Yeah, that's right. He wrote the foreword to the book.
So often when I have read or heard lectures on the philosophy of religion, they tend to come from Christian lecturers. And many of them make a really good case for the existence of God from a philosophical approach, from a psychological approach. But then they go from, okay, a transcendent power exists, hence Christianity must be true. Your book doesn't do that. I want to explain, even though you are a Christian, I searched all the way through the book. I couldn't find that leap. How do people make that leap? And obviously, you did not take that route. I'm assuming that that must be purposeful.
Yeah. No. So this book would be written for anyone who believes in God, and actually for people who don't. I mean, I am looking at the psychology of belief in God, and I don't mean the psychology of belief in Yahweh or Allah or God, as Christians tend to say, or the Father. Or I just, what I say here could be of interest to Buddhists, Muslims, Hindus.
Oh, absolutely. No question.
There's nothing especially Christian about this book. And that's intentional. I think, you know, in this day and age, I'd say the biggest alternative, the biggest sort of worldview alternative, and it's increasingly clear to religious belief is atheism. And I think, you know, in the 12th century, Christians thought the biggest alternative was Muslims, mm-hmm. and they need to be stopped. And I think a lot of apologetics, Christian and Muslim alike, is aimed at showing the superiority of either of those views and sort of justifying the mistreatment of people who are different from you. And that's not why I addressed God in general. I think it's really hard to move from, in the typical way philosophers or religion often do it, I think it's really hard to move from pretty good arguments from the existence of God to good arguments for your own particular religion. Those are always harder, way harder claims to make.
Yeah, leaps of faith.
So yeah, those are pretty big leaps of faith. And I'm, you know, if you ask me why people do it, my biggest why would be sociological. People tend to believe what they were brought up with. Mm-hmm. So that would be my biggest reason why people do it, which I think is perfectly fine. That's how we acquire a lot of our beliefs. But that bothers people if I say that. What they want is proof that their religion is intellectually superior.
Oh, really? You do get that complaint from people?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Or I just hear it in the way people, the way philosophers deal with issues. I just hear, there's a sort of arrogance and superiority in their voices when they say it. And so I'm a Christian, but I don't feel like I'm really doing anything much different or better than my Muslim or Hindu brother or sister. So I wish I could say I could. I wanted to be able to do that at one time. I just think neither of us are really have any intellectual grounds for arrogance or superiority.
You say, speaking of atheists, you said something that I don't think I've ever seen this figure before. And I'm assuming you stand behind it, that the atheist population of the United States is 2.4%. Do you remember that?
Well, it's funny. When I wrote the book, it probably... So here's the problem. These are all self-reports, and a lot of people will under-report an unpopular view, and atheism is an unpopular view in the United States. For example... 55% of Americans a few years ago said that they would vote for a Muslim for president, but only about 35% of Americans said they would vote for an atheist. So it's like, it's hard to believe given Islamophobia, but on average, Americans think atheists are even worse than Muslims. That's the figure. But
it just surprised me. It seems on the low side.
Right. So I think people don't self-report.
Okay.
And that figure is old. If you read, there has been a dramatic increase from when I wrote the first draft of that book to now in the number of people who are willing to self-identify as atheists in the United States. And so,
no kidding.
So I think whatever number you have is likely to be low, because I think people Okay. There's a sort of fear of self-reporting.
Sure, because I was going to say, if it really is 2.4%, that I believe that between you and me, we know all of them.
Yeah, yeah, we know both of them in Grand Rapids.
I think we do. I think we do. Just the circles we run in.
Yeah.
Speaking of college, you talked about how this started with a former student of yours, but I want to talk about a former teacher of yours. You say you were in college, it was a humanities class, and you had a professor who described Paul's conversion on the road to Damascus as some sort of misfired brain neurons.
Yeah.
How did this affect your belief at the time? And was this a prevailing attitude in your school?
Well, I was at Michigan State University, and I think, in all honesty, universities are pretty secular, and there are a lot of sort of atheist evangelists at in universities, and I think he was one of them. And he was presenting the view, which I think is not uncommon, that Paul may have had an epileptic seizure. And epileptic seizures are sometimes correlated with people having visions of the divine. And in fact, a lot of psychological sort of misfirings are often involve religious beliefs or religious visions. And there are interesting parallels between the way Paul describes what happened to him, like a sensitivity to light, for example, which sometimes people who have epileptic seizures write about. So his suggestion was that Paul didn't really have a genuine encounter with God. What he did was he had a brain phantasm, and he attributed it to God. And so it's what I call in the book, you just believe that because argument. You just believe in God because you mistook your brain phantasm for reality.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Kelly Clark, and we are talking about his book, God in the Brain, The Rationality of Belief. Back to that point, though, I mean, if we went to Pine Rest right now and talked with people who may have had some sort of pseudo religious experience, seeing God or Jesus or anything like that, do you think that they would write as cogently and intelligently as Paul did? Theologically.
Yeah. No, so that's a good point. It's hard to imagine, sort of theological and philosophical sophistication and narrative sophistication from this. I think it could happen. I there's almost nothing I would rule out these days sure. when I see how the mind really works and how people really form beliefs. But I'll just tell you this. If I didn't believe in God, I'd say, well, then what did happen to St. Paul? And I might think, well, maybe this is what happened to him. I don't think anybody can say that with any confidence. And if you did, if you do believe in God, you might think, what happened to St. Paul was that he got knocked off his high horse, literally, or donkey or high donkey or something. He got literally knocked off by the light. And the light was that, God doesn't, and then the mission is that God doesn't just love Jews. He loves everybody, which I take it is a good thing. It was an advance. He ended up not being the most loving person in the whole world. And yet I think he saw what I take to be some deep truth about God, that God loves everybody and not just some particular tribe. So that sort of resonates with what I think about the divine. So it fits in better with what I believe. But if I were an atheist, I would just think, oh, well, we need some explanation for why this guy did this. Here's why.
Sure. Let's talk about a former atheist. Is it pronounced Eben Alexander or Eben Alexander?
I think it's Eben Alexander.
Okay. So go ahead and explain his story.
Alexander is a Harvard-trained neurologist, and he does, as far as I can tell, brain surgery. And he had a near-death experience. And prior to the near-death experience, he didn't believe in God. And in the near-death experience, I think it's an angel greets him. There's some common features, actually, of near-death experiences. You know, you go through a long tunnel, you move from darkness into light. It's usually warm and inviting. And he sort of got a tour, which he, from by this angel, of what he took to be like the gates of heaven. Like, we're getting close. This is what it's like. And it was so vivid that he completely changed his life. He wrote a book about it. And he has really vivid descriptions of what he thinks the next life looks like. Anyway, it changed him from atheist to religious believer. And as you can imagine, because he was a prominent scientist and not a kook, he was derided by people in the scientific establishment.
Here's the thing that puzzles me. You say in the book that he was given last rites by his rector. Why does an atheist need a rector? Or last rites.
Yeah, it is weird. I think he had a sort of casual friendship with the rector, and he probably had a religious background, and maybe his wife called the rector, and I don't recall exactly. I can't remember from it, but I include the detail in my book because people, and he includes the detail in the book because people, he wants people to think that he was either dead or pretty darn close. And he does say that there was no record of his heart beating, and I think part of his brain. There was nothing, he says there was nothing going on in his brain that for 15 seconds or something before they revived him. And so there wasn't something in his brain, he thought, that was producing this. It was, he was dead, and he wasn't, you know, in his body. He was out of his body in heaven. And so his body was dead and he was off to another place.
Yeah. Several years ago, we had one of the great pioneers of near-death experiences on this program. And it was fascinating. And I would say even to people who have no concept of anything after life ends, they would find it compelling to listen to this gentleman. And he told me that he relished going up in front of anybody who had a different worldview, who believed that we're just worm food after that point. He said, if you can get me on any radio shows with people who completely disagree with the possibility of an immortal soul, I want Adam. He was just,
yeah.
You know, almost evangelical, I guess, would be the term.
There's a funny, one of the 20th century's most famous philosophical atheists, A.J. Ayer, wrote in his autobiography that he had a near-death experience, that he had a heart attack. He was on the in the hospital, and he was dead. But his experience was that it was getting more and more dark until... And then more and more hot and more uncomfortable. And there were flames licking up at his feet. And then he came back to life.
When my father-in-law was receiving CPR, my wife was there. And she realized that he really did want to be released. He really did.
Yeah.
So you have her going, Dad, go to the light, go to the light, all right? But you had these EMT people working on him. So it was kind of, you know, they were working against each other. Finally, when my wife remembered that, sometimes you see people when you're in that state. You see loved ones and all that. And she was saying, go to Mom. Mom, are you there? Go to Mom. And all of a sudden the EMT guy goes, we have a pulse.
Too late.
It's like all of a sudden it's, oh, my wife, I'm going back. They did not have a marriage made in heaven, put it that way.
This should be in a comedy. a sitcom or something.
She's planning on that.
She's got a plan for it. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Now, there are also people in science who believe that what we call religious experiences, spiritual experiences, can be produced through means they consider scientific, and they would consider getting knocked off your horse on the way to Damascus, or a yogi in meditational bliss. They would consider that fantasy, but they would consider, no, if you just, you know, touch this part of the brain, boom, you've got something. But then again, it really isn't religious, such as the God helmet. Let's talk about that.
So there was a famous claim by Michael Persinger, a neuroscientist in Canada because he was, I'm pretty sure he was a draft dodger in the 60s. So he's American, but he works in Canada. And he alleges to have created a God helmet which replicates religious experiences. It finds the part of the brain where people sort of meet God, so to speak. And so his claim is that that he can artificially generate religious beliefs with electromagnetic waves is what it is, that that are passed through the brain somehow and are stimulating the brain. So he's done this experiment on quite a number of people. People go into a dark room. It's completely dark. It's completely quiet. And they put this helmet on, and the helmet has these electrodes that stimulate the brain. And it, probably the most famous atheist of the past couple of decades, Richard Dawkins, wanted to have what a religious experience. And so he went to this and put the helmet on, was in there, and he didn't have a religious experience, and he was unhappy. Persinger says maybe it's because Dawkins had too much to drink before he went in. Other people did have something like it, but when you look at what people say, at first it could just be the power of suggestion. It wasn't double blind, so there were people who were setting up the experiments might have created expectations on the part of people that they should have this. So the God helmet's been, the God helmet study has been replicated in Sweden, or has been redone in Sweden, but the results weren't replicated when it was double blind. So the experimenter doesn't know what results you're supposed to get. So there isn't the kind of power of suggestion operating there. They couldn't reproduce the results of the God helmet. And they said the electricity that's flowing through the helmet isn't powerful enough to make any changes in the brain whatsoever. And so it probably was just the power of suggestion on the part of some of the experimenters, and a kind of susceptibility on the part of the participants.
Did they at least end up with a permanent?
No. <You know. laughs> Nope.
Okay. Well, then what's the point?
Exactly.
You know, it reminds me.
You can buy one, by the way, on the internet.
Can you really?
You can buy a God helmet, and you can, in the safety of your own home, electro-stimulate your brain, have a God experience. But
what you're telling me is maybe you will, maybe you won't.
Yeah. I'm saying you probably will if you want one.
Okay. You know, what this reminds me of, a couple of things. First of all, the people who really claim to have legitimate spiritual experiences, the people that I have known in my life, and the people who I don't believe belong in Pine Rest or Forest View, when they have had these experiences, their lives to some degree change. The same way that people who report near-death experiences, their lives change. I suspect that the people who put on the God helmet, I could be wrong because I don't know anybody, and who claim to have a religious experience, do they walk out different people? Are they more compassionate? Are they more introspective?
That's a good question. I don't know if that's been studied, or if it's been studied, like, does it catch for a long period of time? You know, does it really catch on? I think the experiences are so transient that you find in those, not the ones you were describing, but in the God Helmet experience, that probably not much. But they do find, for example, there's a lot of studies. I don't discuss them in there about the power of meditation to change brains.
Yeah.
It does make people different people. There's just no doubt about it. And
no, it's guaranteed.
And it can do it, interestingly, in the case of atheists. So atheists who meditate can have a wider sense that they're part of one thing, you know, that people aren't just distinct in parts of crowds, that they're that the world is greater than them. There are all sorts of things that make people more likely to be kind and compassionate to other people. And studies are really clear on the power of meditation to do that. And honestly, religious experiences, especially, you know, a lot. So we're talking a lot about individuals here. What happens to most people is they're parts of communities and they take part in rituals. And so we're parts of groups. And there are lots of group activities that every religious group does that kind of unselfish, that they make us less selfish if we do them and more other oriented. So moving your body around in various ways can shape your soul, so to speak.
We're going to have to leave it there, Kelly. We are out of time for this episode of Common Threads, but I've got more questions. Hope you'll be back next week and we can continue our conversation.
Thanks, Fred. I look forward to it.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. My guest today, Kelly Clark, and talking about his book, God in the Brain, The Rationality of Belief. Hope you can join us next week right here on WGVU.